This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, February 11, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Mexico's Secretary of State opens the doors for an investigation into paramilitary activity in Chiapas. Nigeria considers military force against the nearby West African country of Togo. And critics compare the latest anti-immigration legislation to the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Pauline Bartolone with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. today announced its refusal to meet in bilateral talks with North Korea on the country's nuclear weapons program. This comes after North Korea announced yesterday it was pulling out of six-party talks aimed at disarming the country. The U.S., China, South Korea, Japan, and Russia have already met in three rounds of negotiations. North Korea said it has nuclear weapons to defend itself against a hostile White House. According to John Wolfstahl, director of nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the U.S. needs to show North Korea that it is serious about reaching a settlement.
I think the United States should pursue all avenues for negotiation, which includes using the six-party talks, but also being serious about using bilateral opportunities, whether that's as part of the six-party talks or not.
White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said North Korea's nuclear programs are a regional problem and require a multilateral approach. The seventh round of the Andean Free Trade negotiations ends today in Cartagena, Colombia. The agreements will include the U.S., Colombia, Peru, and Ecuador, but were protested widely throughout Colombia. Nicole Carson has more.
Yesterday, thousands of Colombia's workers, farmers, students, indigenous groups, even legislators, demonstrated in four of Colombia's largest cities. At the demonstration in Medellin, 18 alleged protesters were seriously wounded when a homemade bomb they were concocting accidentally exploded inside the chemistry lab of the Antioquia University. Among the concerns of Colombian civil society is the issue of intellectual property clauses that would prohibit the local production of generic drugs and cause medicine costs in South America to soar. Trade unions and farmers say that the entry of cheap food imports produced by U.S. subsidized farmers would be ruinous to their local economies. At least one more round of negotiations will be scheduled before an agreement is signed. From Bogota, this is Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
Justice Department lawyers today told a federal judge in Washington the U.S. has no jurisdiction over the detention of U.S. citizen Ahmed Abu Ali in Saudi Arabia. Ingrid Drake from the D.C. Radio Co-op reports on the Abu Ali family's fight for due process.
Ahmed Abu Ali is a U.S. citizen who has been detained in Saudi Arabia since June 2003. His father, Omar Abu Ali, filed a lawsuit to force U.S. authorities to return his 24-year-old son, who he believes has been tortured, to the United States for a trial.
My son was arrested while he was taking the final exam in the university on the behest of the U.S. government. He was there with no charges, no lawyers, nothing.
The government is pushing to dismiss the Abu Ali's case because it involves secret evidence. The family's attorney, David Cole.
If the government were to prevail on the theory it's presented here, that it can lock people up by outsourcing their detention to another country, in this instance Saudi Arabia, and can then throw out any legal challenge to its action based on secret evidence, then there are no meaningful checks on the government's detention authority.
Madi Bray from the Muslim American Society was one of more than 100 people gathered in the U.S. District Courtroom.
Democracy flourishes in sunshine, never in darkness.
Judge John Bates will not rule whether to dismiss or hear the case until both parties submit another brief by next Friday. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake with the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Meanwhile, in upstate New York, a jury has convicted a prominent Iraqi-born oncologist of fraud and money laundering. From Syracuse, Catherine Comp reports.
Iraqi-American Rafael Dafir has been in jail since February 2003, when more than 85 armed federal agents descended on his home, put a gun in his wife's face, and confiscated dozens of boxes and records. Dafir's charity, Help the Needy, had been sending money to Iraq, a violation of U.S. sanctions. Attorney General John Ashcroft and Governor George Pataki were quick to link him to terrorism, though investigators never found any evidence of this kind of activity. Defense Attorney Devereaux Kanik says his client was unfairly treated because of his race and religion.
It just confirmed, though, in my mind, how much an advantage the government has when it comes to dealing with the Arab American community, the general suspicion that people have about Arabs. And it's a situation we're in. For this jury to come back with the verdict that it did, it just confirmed that they bought into the government's theory, hook, line, and sinker.
The jury convicted Dafir of 59 out of 60 counts, and he faces decades in prison and millions of dollars in fines when sentenced in June. The defense plans to appeal. In Syracuse, I'm Catherine Kamp.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Attorney Lynn Stewart's guilty verdict sent shockwaves across the progressive community and has stirred debate among the legal profession. And as FSRN correspondent Leanne Caldwell reports from New York City, Lynn Stewart is planning for the next phase of legal proceedings.
Well, I think they were able to do it by means of fear, basically. You know, that fear that has pervaded the U.S. ever since 9/11.
Lynn Stewart spoke with FSRN in an interview last night shortly after her conviction. The evidence in her case consisted of more than 1,500 hours of taped phone conversations between Stewart and her client, the Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who was convicted of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. It also consisted of a press release in which Stewart passed to a Reuters reporter that said that the Sheikh withdrew his support for an Islamic-Egyptian ceasefire, and also a tape of Osama bin Laden.
And I just feel that the government was able to parlay that fear and do it by, you know, bringing up everything from the Nazi Holocaust. And, of course, as we complained and fought and tried to make the judge stand up for the, you can't put bin Laden into a case in the United States today and not get an effect from that. It's just like the old thing, you can't throw a skunk in the jury box and tell people not to smell it. So I think that even though the judge said this has nothing to do with this case, he has nothing to do with this case, that was the message to the jury. We are the government. We are here to protect. You should do what we tell you because we are Big Brother. And I think that's how they managed it.
After the tape of Osama bin Laden was shown, the U.S. District Judge John Kodal told jurors to disregard it as it had nothing to do with his case. Lynn Stewart was found guilty on all five counts yesterday, including conspiring to assist in terrorism activity and defrauding the government. Her Arabic translator Muhammad Yusri and the paralegal Ahmed Abdel Sattar were also convicted. Newly appointed Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez released a statement that said this verdict is an important step in the war on terrorism and, quote, a message that this department will pursue both those who carry out acts of terrorism and those who assist them with their murderous goals. In 3 weeks, Lynn Stewart's legal team will file a motion to dismiss evidence and to overturn her guilty verdict. Following the standard process, which usually results in no change, an appeal will be filed to the U.S. Court of Appeals, according to Stewart's attorney, Michael Tiger. The case has created a debate among the legal profession. Harvey Fistbein of the New York Criminal Bar Association said Lynn Stewart went beyond her duties as an advocate and attorney. But former Attorney General Ramsey Clark testified in Stewart's defense. And Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, said this case is another attack from the Bush administration in curtailing the rights of the accused to seek legal counsel.
For example, all the detainees at Guantanamo were held without lawyers. The government said that it had the right to name people as enemy combatants, such as Mr. Hamdi and Mr. Padilla, and to hold them without lawyers. The government enacted the Patriot Act.
He also said that among the National Lawyers Guild's 6,000 members, plans are being drawn to conduct forums in a national campaign to raise awareness on the curtailing of these rights. Meanwhile, concerned lawyers groups have indicated that they expect to file amicus briefs challenging the outcome of this case because they say it jeopardizes the role of counsel to represent their clients adequately. Martin Adelman is former president of the New York Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
It would concern us that lawyers in unpopular causes risk intrusion into their relationship and, God forbid, even criminal prosecution if it's seen that what they did was beyond the pale of what lawyering is about. It's scary.
The association expects to file amicus, as does the National Lawyers Guild and, according to Lynn Stewart's office, the New York Civil Liberties Union. Lynn Stewart's sentencing is July 15th, where she can receive up to 20 years in prison. She's out on bail until then and throughout the appeal process. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Mexico's Secretary of State, Santiago Krill, made a statement late Thursday opening the doors for an in-depth investigation into the Mexican military's participation in the formation and training of paramilitaries as a strategy to disintegrate support for the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or EZLN for its Spanish acronym, in Chiapas from 1995, continuing through today. In this exclusive report from San Cristobal de las Casas, we learn that Grill's statement contradicted the executive branch's dismissal of a damaging report issued by the Fray Bartolomé de las Casas Human Rights Center, released 10 years ago to the day after ex-president Zedillo launched the February 9, 1995 military offensive against the EZLN that ended the peace negotiations. Luz Ruiz and Tim Russo bring you more.
According to PJ, an ex-commander from the Peace and Justice paramilitary group in Chiapas, who is being held in protective custody, high-level Mexican military officials were at the heart of the formation of paramilitary groups in Chiapas as part of a major counterinsurgency plan. The plan is outlined in a document known as Plan Campaign Chiapas 94, a military strategy authored by now-retired General Renan Castillo, graduate from Fort Bragg in North Carolina in psychological and counterinsurgency warfare, who commanded the military in Chiapas under President Zedillo.
They started to train us with the help from the Mexican army. They supported and protected us and wanted us to finish off the Zapatistas in the northern zone. An agent organized us. I had my uniform, I had my own gun, and learned to use many weapons. I carried an AK-47, and they taught me many things about weapons.
Paramilitaries in Chiapas are responsible for Mexico's worst refugee crisis, forcibly displacing more than 12,000 indigenous peoples in Chiapas and killing hundreds more. Diego Cadenas, spokesman from the Fray Bartolomé Human Rights Center, the group that authored the report The Politics of Genocide in the Chiapas Armed Conflict and the case that has reached the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, explains the role of paramilitaries in Chiapas.
Peace and Justice mainly work in the northern region of Chiapas, a predominantly Chol area. Their main tasks were to destroy the morale of the Zapatista sympathizers and support bases and indiscriminately promote terror. We have documented 122 cases of executions and disappearances attributed to Peace and Justice. The strategy was not only to kill or eliminate, but rather to kill in brutal ways to generate fear and use psychological operations.
The testimonies by PJ have implicated Mexican generals, federal senators, and the ex-governor of Chiapas in illegal dealings that channeled hundreds of thousands of dollars, arms, munitions, and communications equipment to Peace and Justice and other paramilitary organizations. PJ testifies that the generals and politicians were the intellectual authors of the assassination attempts against Nobel Peace Prize candidate Bishop Samuel Ruiz and Bishop Raúl Vera in 1997.
These politicians had so much anger towards Samuel Ruiz, San Cristobal's bishop, because they said he was talking about what was happening in the communities, in the municipalities. And that's why they wanted to kill him. He was supposedly going to pass on a road close to us, so 28 of us were armed to ambush him and shoot him. If he would have actually passed through that road, we would have killed him, because we were well protected and had a very, very good plan.
General Castillo was a signatory witness to a 1997 transaction between Peace and Justice paramilitary group and the state government that authorized more than $600,000 in cash to the paramilitaries for, quote, production projects. Ernesto Ledesma from CAPICE, a Chiapas-based non-governmental organization specializing in militarization, says that the complicity and impunity reaches the highest levels of the current Fox administration. Such is the case with Attorney General Rafael Macedo de la Concha, affirms Ledesma.
This goes further than a retired general that committed crimes against humanity. De la Concha, who was Attorney General for Military Justice under President Zedillo, is now the Attorney General of the country, designated so by President Vicente Fox. The Attorney General's office, an institution that should have a civil authority, actually has a military one. From 1994 to February 2005, when De la Concha was Attorney General for the military, not a single soldier has been punished or sentenced for the crimes that they committed.
Today, Chiapas continues to be the most militarized state in Mexico, with nearly a third of all federal troops stationed on indigenous lands. Impunity continues to be rampant, as evident in the murder of two indigenous leaders in the last 10 days, one by Peace and Justice, and another yet to be attributed to any particular group. The release of PJ's testimonies has placed the Fox administration back against a wall to investigate the hundreds of pending cases, federal and military complicity. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Luz Ruiz with Tim Russo in Mexico.
A late amendment to the anti-immigration measure passed yesterday by the House of Representatives, known as the Real ID Act, gives the Department of Homeland Security the authority to require all immigrants who are awaiting deportation hearings to post bond. Currently, about 13% of all immigrants who receive deportation orders actually leave, and supporters of the amendment say it would ensure all immigrants that are told to leave to do so. But, as Mitch Jezerich reports, critics contend that it would give broad deportation authority to bounty hunters and jail bondsmen, as critics compare it to the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act.
The U.S. Senate has been commonly called the old white man's club. However, travel down to the Capitol basement and one quickly finds many people of color, mostly immigrants, serving food and cleaning the Senate cafeterias. According to cafeteria worker Les Leah, not her real name, there are many in the cafeteria and janitorial staff at the U.S. Capitol who are undocumented immigrants. She says immigrants work in the Capitol for very little money. She says some make as little as $8.50 an hour, even while they work 8 hours a day. She says she has no health insurance and no vacation time, and she doesn't get reimbursed for travel because she's considered to be self-employed. Nosotros tenemos que pagar aparte porque ellos nos declaran como self-employment. Soon, the U.S. Senate will be considering whether to accept a bill known as the Real ID Act, passed by the House on Thursday, that could put a bounty on the heads of many of those workers who clean the U.S. Senate cafeterias, offices, and bathrooms. An amendment to the Real ID Act would require immigrants with deportation hearings to post bail in order to remain free. Republican Representative Pete Sessions of Texas is the amendment's sponsor.
These are aliens who have been ordered deported by a federal judge as a result of a hearing, who do not show up. They've had their day in court. The process is through. They've been ordered deported, and only 13% actually are deported.
Several members from the Congressional Black Caucus, such as Benny Thompson of Mississippi, were outraged by the amendment.
We should not outsource the Department of Homeland Security's job to a bunch of bounty hunters. As already has been said, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 has very similar language to this amendment. And for those of you who have not suffered from the ills of slavery and what people went through, I want to share and encourage you to look at this amendment very clearly before it comes to a vote.
There's a provision in the bill that says, and I'm quoting, at any time before a breach of any bond conditions, if in the opinion of the bail bondsman, the person constitutes a flight risk, that person can be detained.
Tracy Hong is with the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium.
It gives completely unheard of powers to bail bondsmen, again, who are not trained in law enforcement, who are not trained to respect people's due process. And also, even if they're not bad people, they now have a serious financial incentive to go after immigrants who have not yet completed removal proceedings and may therefore in the end not be deportable at all.
This has basically opened up a market share for the bail agents who write for our companies to do more bail bonds.
Dennis Bartlett is the executive director of the American Bail Coalition, a lobbying group for the jail bond industry. He says though the Sessions Amendment could be financially rewarding for the industry, he also says it could create risks.
For those aliens who have been picked up, who have no collateral, no address, no indemnitors or friends or family or whatever, it would be very, very risky to write a bond for these people because you could almost count on their not coming back.
For those who couldn't afford the bond, as it is likely to cost at least $1,000, would then have to remain in detention. The bill will likely face stiff opposition in the Senate. However, the House Republican leadership is considering to attach the Real ID Act to the president's $80 billion request for Iraq and Afghanistan in an attempt to force the bill through. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
International pressure is mounting against the new leadership in the West African state of Togo. After the death of President Niasingbe Ayadema, one of the world's longest-serving leaders, the military in the country handpicked his son to succeed him. This has caused outrage, with legislators in Nigeria asking President Obasanjo to intervene militarily. Sam Olokoya reports from Lagos.
President Basima Ayadema ruled Togo for 38 years before his death less than a week ago. Against the provisions of the country's constitution, which requires the Speaker of Parliament to take over power, the military picked the late president's son to succeed him. This decision has caused outrage both within and outside Togo. Victoria Dovie is a Togolese resident in Nigeria.
So as Ayadema died now, my mom be say as they go carry him pikin put there is very, very wrong and bad.
It is very bad that the late Ayadema is being succeeded by his son. I want any other person to be there except Ayadema's son. He will do the same things that his father did.
I think nobody go know this way the own pikin self go come take over now.
We appeal to the international community to make our country better. What Ayadema did to Togo is very bad.
The way Ayadema do was very bad.
During his reign, Ayadema ran an undemocratic government that allowed him to hold on to power till his death. Many people in Africa fear that the decision of the Togolese military to impose President Ayadema's son on the country has serious implications for the growth of democracy in Africa, as the military in other countries on the continent could emulate their Togolese counterparts. Sylvester Odion Akhene is of the Center for Constitutionalism and Demilitarization in Lagos.
It has implications for transition paradigms, where you think that the mode of succession will always be by elections, periodic elections, because the state actors in West Africa or in Africa are not civic enough to allow those modes of power transfer. And so, if that is the prevalent mood, then the incident that has just happened in Togo or replicated elsewhere in Africa.
As international pressure mounts on the Togolese military to respect the country's constitution, West African leaders have abandoned a planned trip to Togo aimed at discussing the crisis after a plane carrying government officials from Nigeria was refused landing at the Togolese capital. Nigeria, the regional power, has reacted angrily by recalling its ambassador to Togo. Nigeria's National Assembly has asked President Olusegun Obasanjo to intervene militarily. Tony Iyare, an international relations expert, supports the call for military action.
I think the situation has called for that. You know, if the Togolese leaders do not think that they should abide by the constitution, you know, we must begin to contemplate the likelihood of a military action, you know, against Togo. And I've always said that Togo can be sacked, you know, by just a garrison.
Within Togo itself, tension is mounting as police dispersed demonstrators with tear gas. Iyare says the outcome of the crisis will demonstrate Africa's ability to uphold democratic values. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
The struggle against the Iranian regime by expatriates took on global proportions yesterday when a second European government withdrew permission for a pro-democracy rally, which was to be attended by around 40,000 Iranians in exile. Many are now questioning just how viable free speech is in Europe. The group National Council for Resistance of Iran call themselves the Third Way since they oppose the current regime, as well as any Western invasion of Iran, and instead want Iranians to choose their own future in their country. In Berlin, Naomi Fowler has more.
This was to be the biggest demonstration by Iranians outside Iran. It's something that wouldn't happen in Iran without executions and persecution, but here in the heart of democratic Europe, it almost wasn't allowed at all. A week before the rally was due to take place in Paris, the French government withdrew its permission with no explanation. And at 4 a.m. on the day of the demonstration, the German authorities also withdrew permission.
The Europeans have had extensive commercial ties with Tehran. France particularly signed contracts worth tens of billions of dollars, and of course Germans and others as well.
Dr. Ali Savavi of the National Council of Resistance for Iran.
So it seems to us that the commercial interests have taken precedence over values and principles which Europe has cherished for many, many years, namely human rights and the free speech, democratic values. So unfortunately, I think the Iranian people have paid the price.
However, just as an unofficial demonstration was gathering force, the following announcement came.
An emergency court in Berlin, which has been considering since this morning the request by the organizers of the rally to overturn the decision to ban the rally at Brandenburg Platz, has now announced its decision. The judge has ruled that the demonstration can be held in Brandenburg at all. So the Iranians have been told that they will go, even though hundreds of buses have been turned away, people have been turned away from train stations, people have been turned away from airports, and many of them will not be there today with us, but even symbolically we will go there to make sure that human rights triumph.
We are not for the war. We don't accept the war. At the same time, we don't want the mullahs. And the third way, let the Iranian people decide for themselves.
This third way is the National Council for Resistance of Iran, the main organized opposition for democratic change in Iran for the last two decades. Because of the failure by the West to impose economic sanctions, they propose to overthrow the regime, and President-elect Mariam Rajavi would preside over the interim government until the elections, which they're committed to after 6 months. However, the armed group dedicated to do this, the People's Mujahideen of Iran, is on the US and the EU terror list. They believe that's a political decision by the West protecting their commercial interests. The United States also has the group imprisoned in Camp Ashraf on the Iran-Iraq border. Despite national European government attitudes to the organisation, the European Parliament recently recognised them as only interested in liberating Iran and voted to take them off the terrorism list. Member of the European Parliament, Struan Stevenson.
But as the people who've gathered here today, I stand side by side, shoulder to shoulder with them, in calling for democracy, for liberation for the people of Iran. And the way to do that is to remove the terror tag from the People's Mujahideen of Iran, get them off the terror list. There is a third way which does not involve military intervention in Iran, a way which backs the people of Iran who are crying out for liberty and freedom. That is the way to get rid of the mullahs, to get rid of the ayatollahs, and to restore a secular democracy to that beleaguered country. Thank you very much.
Dr. Ali Savavi again.
If we are interested to see democratic change in Iran, the solution is the Iranian people and the resistance. And so that is why the main theme of this rally today was no war, no appeasement, support the Iranian resistance and the Iranian people and help them bring about democratic change in their country.
Although this day saw the reinstatement of these people's right to protest, it also demonstrated the power of economic ties and Europe's vested interests. This is Naomi Fowler at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.